Some automotive CEOs make a lot more money than others. Other executives quit well before their time. And Ford comes out with a pickup truck for drag racers. This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 202 for June 28th of 2013. A peek inside Ford's PR strategy.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Mr. D.
John, how are you?
I'm doing okay. If we don't blow away here with the thunderstorms, I don't know, tornadoes here. It's unreal, man. I feel safe here inside the studio. This place is built like a battleship.
Well, that's good.
And Gary Vasilash, we got to say hello to you and welcome back. You're great having you on
good
the show.
Welcome back. You've been gone a lot.
I've been gone a long time.
Where have you been?
Well, since the last time I was in Germany, I was back in Germany again, and then was in San Diego earlier this week.
San Diego.
Yes.
So San Diego was...
Where in the world is?
Carmen, San Diego. So the Nissan Versa Note is what the San Diego... And you can't talk about that, right? Because it's embargoed.
I can't give my driving impressions, apparently.
Other than that, it exists.
It exists.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
does. And but the thing is that I believe it is available at dealerships at this very moment.
So. Even though we can't talk about it.
Yeah, and so that's very odd. And they also had the NV200 cargo van.
What'd you think?
Which is...
To me, it looks hideous.
Well, you know, I mean, they have that design language that they're working with the larger ones, right? With the, you know, the bigger cargo people carrier product. And... So they've basically shrunk it down, and this will be the taxi of tomorrow for New York City going forward, starting in October. But what's sort of interesting is that unlike the Transit Connect, which I'm sure that our guest may talk about, that you can't buy an NV200 with seats for passengers. It comes with a driver's seat and a front passenger seat, and the rest of it is cargo. So what they had to do was they had to basically, you know, create seats to put in it for the New York cabs. But I find it very unusual that these things, I think, will have a certain popularity as replacements for SUVs or you know, just people haulers in the Transit Connect version. And why Nissan isn't doing that is very puzzling to me.
Wow.
It's an unfortunate-looking cab, too. I'm not really ready to see that in New York.
No. Like I said, it looks hideous. You know, hey, if the thing drives well and it's reliable and, you know, really is good for taxi users, mm-hmm. great, that's fine. But it sure does not look good, not to my eye. And then Germany, you said back in, where was that the Volkswagen GTD?
Yes. And now this...
GT, the new one?
It's the diesel version of the GTI.
Right.
Yeah. And, so instead of GTI, GTD right. for diesel.
And it is not confirmed for the U.S. market.
Except that they brought a bunch of American journalists over
to
drive it.
And boy, I'll tell you, what a fantastic vehicle that is.
It is
solid. It is fun. It's got wonderful performance. I mean, it was just a revelation. I mean, we put a lot of miles on the thing. I mean, it was a long drive. At one point, we thought we were lost, you know, because we were just like, geez, we must be at a place where we're done. And we just kept going and going and going and going. So, I mean, it was a lot of driving, and that was good. And the other part of it, which was also very interesting, was the XL1, the one-liter car,
yeah.
the new version of
Did
the one-liter car.
Did you get to
drive that? I got to drive that.
What'd you think of that?
I'll tell you, it is the most unusual driving experience I've ever had in my life.
Okay. Details.
All right, so now this is a production car, okay? So far they have produced 50, and they'll be producing 200 more, so it'll be 250 run,
okay,
of the entire vehicle.
So it's got to be super expensive.
Well, they didn't even talk about price. I mean,
I'm guessing it's going to be 80 grand.
80?
100?
250 cars? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
they're going to lose money on every one.
Well, there's no, I mean, it's, I think that the sales of this thing are completely irrelevant. I just think it's the technology play that they have on it. But here's the thing that was very unsurprising to me. Okay. So it is basically a range extended electric vehicle because it has a three-cylinder diesel motor, okay, is in addition to the electric drive. And the chassis is carbon fiber, okay? The thing is ultra lightweight. They did everything to take weight out of this thing. They made every effort they could to make it aerodynamic. The difference between the one that Piëch drove to the...
With Piëch right behind him.
Behind him was the fact that, you know, they didn't like that it was the motorcycle setup, right? Yeah. And so what they did was they've moved it over so the passenger seat is adjacent to the driver's seat. It's not next to the driver's seat. It is adjacent to
and
the
behind.
Driver's seat. So it's slightly behind. It's sort of the play that the Scion IQ has. You know, the passenger seat is sort of set back so you can get some additional room there. Well, so you have this carbon fiber chassis, okay? And there is no rear window, no backlight. Okay, you look there, it is a wall of carbon fiber is there, right? There are no side view mirrors, and naturally there's no rear view mirror.
It's all cameras.
Because you couldn't see anything. It's cameras. And so they had to get the German government to sign off on allowing this to be street legal for these production cars, right? And so in the door panels are video monitors. I mean, you know, the retinal display on the iPads are pretty damn good. These things were like ultra retinal display. I don't know where this came from, but I mean, it was amazing. And the thing that was fascinating is that not only did it give you side view, but you could see the car right behind you. Okay, so somehow they were able to, you know.
I wonder if they use OLEDs.
Maybe that was it. But
what are those?
That's the next wave, organic LEDs.
Yeah. Oh, that are bendable and everything.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And,
but the resolution of OLED is like a whole other dimension.
Hmm. So we're driving this, and so I was driving it in Wolfsburg in rush hour traffic, and so I came to a light, and I had an engineer driving with me, of course, and came to the light, and I was thinking to myself, gee, I'm surprised this doesn't have start-stop, because I can just, you know, I can hear the engine running. Well, imagine my dismay when the engine actually started running and it sounded like a leaf blower was right behind my head, because that's where the engine, what I heard was the electric motor was running. And when this thing turned on, holy Christ, I mean, it was just, because, you know, if you're saving weight, you don't put a whole lot of sound attenuation material there. So it's like behind this carbon fiber, you know, and how stiff carbon fiber is,
so it's
right?
It sounded like a DC-3.
Oh, my God. It was just unbelievable. But, you know, the thing is that we stopped in front of a municipal building in Wolfsburg because a guy wanted to take some photographs. And you should have seen the people
yeah,
just
I believe
flocking
it.
To yeah. this thing. It was just unbelievable. And you think, okay, if you live in Wolfsburg, you got to be seeing wacky things all the time. I mean, it is
yeah,
just...
Yeah, but it's a car crazy over there, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So,
John, I thought you were talking about an Italian Volkswagen I hadn't heard of yet. When you said GTD, I thought you said GTV.
Oh,
I know about GTD. Yeah. So how did it compare to the GTI?
Well, it's basically just a powertrain change.
Well, I know,
and,
but I mean...
Oh, I would, you know, I mean, between the two...
It's got more torque.
It's
and
got,
all that.
Yeah, I mean, it's got all of the characteristics that you'd want in that. And the interesting thing is that the biggest market for the GTI is this market.
You're kidding.
So...
The U.S. market.
Yeah.
I would have never guessed that.
Right. And so, clearly...
Well, every time I drive one, I just say to myself, it's got to be one of the best all-around cars you can buy.
Yeah.
I mean, every time I drive one, it's just like, wow. Yeah.
And this new one is better. I mean, it is absolutely just superb. And so, yeah, that was a good trip.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting company. And
so GTD will be here when, next spring?
2014 sometime.
Even though they didn't say that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's even not confirmed, but... But, I mean, I think the biggest problem they're going to have with that thing, though, is going to be pricing. Because, basically, you know, a lot of people think Golf, and they think, okay, so what are you going to pay for a Golf, right? It's going to be fairly low in price. It's not going to be high. And I think that this thing, I mean, for what it is, the interior fit and finish, just the way the car was executed, the diesel engine, just add it all up, that I would say that this could easily be a $35,000 car, but no one would buy it for $35,000.
Well, the current GTI transaction price must be right around 27.
I believe you're right.
So
Easily
27, yeah, probably more. But, I mean, what are they going to do with the GTD? They can't charge $32,000 for it.
Maybe that's why it's not confirmed yet.
Right. Well, I mean, but that's the thing. I mean, that's the peculiar aspect of this whole thing, though, is if the car, I mean, the car as car, not car as part of the Golf family, the car as what it is, I mean, Shouldn't it be able to demand a price that is fit for the vehicle?
Yeah, but isn't the A3 going to get a diesel, too, in this market?
Probably,
yeah. I believe so.
So, you know.
When, you know,
yeah, but you got the people who's going to buy an A3 and the people who buy GTD.
A3 is the size of an
A4. Same.
And the thing I keep talking about is next year Europe goes to Euro 6 emission standards, which brings them almost even Steven with us, which means they now have to have all this selective catalyst reduction, urea stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the scale of Europe having to go that way is going to bring down diesel prices here dramatically. So I'm told. We'll see if it actually happens.
We'll see if it happens.
We'll see if it happens. You know, they may decide, no, we'll just pocket this profit. But nonetheless, you know, I was looking at diesel versus hybrid sales in the U.S. They're almost even, Stephen. Now, that includes the trucks with diesel, not heavy-duty trucks, but heavy-duty pickups with it.
It's funny you should mention it. You see that
Jerry's always got the numbers right there with him.
Well, this is different. But they released today, University of Michigan did a study on the total cost of ownership, a gas versus a diesel comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and So they did this for the Diesel Technology Forum. And so according to this, quote, the estimates of savings for 3 and 5 years of ownership vary from a low of $67 in 3 years to a high of $15,619 in 5 years. But most of the savings are in the $2,000 to $6,000 range, which also include the extra cost that is usually added to the diesel version of a vehicle.
So you're saying the diesels are cheaper.
The diesels are cheaper.
Even with that upfront cost.
Isn't that surprising?
Does that include depreciation? Do you know? Because diesel vehicles, pass cars in the U.S., really hold their value well.
Hmm. I don't know if it says this. Depreciation.
Oh, it does include it.
11 of the 12 diesel vehicles held their value better than comparable gas vehicles over the 3-year time frame, with 8 vehicles showing double-digit percentage savings ranging from 17%. Up to 46%.
See, and now that's a critical part of the
equation. Oh, and it even gets and that was 11 out of 12 vehicles, and then 9 of the 10 diesel vehicles hold their value better than gas vehicles over 5 years, with 5 vehicles showing double-digit percentage savings ranging from 10% to 39%. So, basically, to your point of diesel, gasoline, so there could be some. Real moves in this area. But, think about it, though. I mean, we had the cruise diesel here, right?
Yeah.
And so absent that, what else is there besides the German products?
Well, the Grand Cherokee, the Mazda 6. And I keep saying, look, if the cruise diesel does even reasonably well, everyone's jumping into the pool. That's my prediction. And if the Grand Cherokee does reasonably well in the SUV segment, you're going to see more in there, too, is what I believe will happen.
Oh, and speaking of the cruise diesel, when I was talking to the Volkswagen people last week, and as you recall that they're making these that Chevy's making comparisons with the Passat, and they're basically saying, like, yeah, that's nice, but you know what? That vehicle's basically at the end of its life cycle. Wait until you see what we got coming next. And so
that's good, though. Hey, look,
they just set that record this week for that guy who drove in the
48. Yeah, but that's hokey.
Well, I understand that.
No, they've had tires you can't buy. Well, you can order the tires. I mean, come on.
And they're driving in ways that better not drive that
normal
way in front of me. Right?
Normal human beings wouldn't want you to do.
Yeah,
hypermileage techniques, which
Yeah, well, let's go back to the Shell mileage standard going back 40 years ago plus.
In the States, you'll get run off the road for that.
It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this is maybe as good a time as anyway. Let's take a quick break and bring our guest Chris Preuss on board.
Really?
So, yeah, why not?
I thought we were going to talk about more snow.
Hey, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. So, Chris Preuss, welcome back to Autoline After Hours.
It's been that long. It feels great. A whole new set. This is very living room-like. I like this. Last time we had the desk.
We're still working on it.
I did the show, and I noticed that the whole time I was swinging in the chair like this in a methodical rhythm, so I probably hypnotized everyone and put them on.
That's a common mistake people do when they get on TV in swivel chairs. Everybody does.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody.
As a PR guy, you're supposed to be able to tell your executive, don't do that. Right. So when you sit there doing it, it's a little...
So the entire audience was mesmerized.
Absolutely.
And the show is over, and they're just still sitting there staring at their television
exactly
sets.
So I want to say the first time we had you on the show is when you were running OnStar at General Motors.
Yep.
And then we had you back after that, and when I think you were at Team Detroit.
Yep, running the global Ford.
And now you're inside Ford. I didn't know this.
Yeah, this just happened. I think this is my third complete week on the job.
So you're what, the head of all public relations for Ford of the Americas.
Yep, and global product.
And global product. Good for you.
Yeah,
wow, I didn't know that. Side.
Yeah.
But, you know, we should remind our viewers that you had a long stint in the dark side at General Motors.
That's true. Yeah, 13 years.
In public relations.
That's
there.
Correct, yeah.
Yes, you were close to Bob Lutz.
Yep, Bob's handler.
Yeah.
You say that pretty good.
After hearing it for so many years, you begin to believe it. Often wrong, never in doubt.
Yeah.
We've got him coming on here in a number of weeks. You know, he's got this new book out called Icons and Idiots.
Yep.
And
it's a great title.
It's a great title. I don't want to just talk about the book, though. I just want to talk the car biz with him.
Yeah.
But
Sadly, I refuse to, you know, stop working forever. I will fall over the... They'll unclutch my dead hand from my desk. He's amazing.
You got his voice down, man.
You know, it was with Jason Vines, also another great Lutz impersonator.
Yeah, Jason was.
Yeah. So.
Well, Jason's a stand-up comic. I mean, you know, he's got the training to do all that sort of thing.
That's true. Well, after 25 years in PR, I've become a stand-up comic, too. Mm. Or at least having changed four CEOs at GM, if you haven't become a comedian or at least have a good sense of humor.
Gotta have a good sense of humor.
But anyway.
So what are you doing at Ford then? I mean, we mentioned the titles, but I mean...
I get to work with most directly Jim Farley and Joe Heinrichs and Raj Nair, who's head of global product, and continue to sort of, you know, keep the Ford story going. It's just been a real great opportunity. Rare that you get to go into the other guys' tent and get underneath and see how everything's done. So Ford's just been a great company. And I grew up a Ford kid. My dad was a longtime Ford PR guy.
I knew him well.
So, yeah, so this was just kind of coming home for me and a lot of the reason that I wanted to be there. But it's just been tremendous. Great executives, great company. Lots of challenges, but also a lot of great opportunities.
So what do you see as being your biggest challenge from a messaging point of view?
I think, you know, going back a couple of years, you know, Ford just had such an amazing set of peripheral circumstances that allowed it to speak and be heard in a way that just rarely ever happens. You know, you're always on message, you're always fine-tuning what you say, and you keep grinding away at it, and you hope to kind of get attention over time. The whole spectacle of them not taking a bailout and the way it changed the conversation just gave Ford this platform that you really get, and they executed brilliantly in that light.
Well, it helps to have Alan Mulally, who's a
absolutely
naturally gifted leader.
Change agent.
Yeah.
And a naturally gifted image presenter for the company.
Yeah, he's amazing. And so the challenge, I think, right now is, you know, how do you, now that, you know, everybody's back on their game and the contrasts aren't nearly as stark as they were. And, you know, frankly, some reality has set in around, you know, the challenges in the industry and how competitive it is. And Ford's got to push through that. So now we've got to, you know, keep that momentum going. And you know, the power of the brand is so critical to the ability to stay profitable and stay successful. And nobody wants to go back to the way it was. And it's one of the most impressive things to me at Ford right now. It's just, this feels different than every other boom and bust cycle I've been through. And I've been at Chrysler, I've been at GM, but there is just a sort of a tenacity there and a determination to stay focused on the business and the things that matter. So we've just got to translate that into brand momentum. And I'm real excited to get back into really building, you know, the product equity and just how good the cars are. I mean,
Ford got clobbered, though, recently in the J.D. Power initial quality survey, consumer reports. And it's all about, you know, my Ford touch and sync. They don't like the touch pads mm-hmm. and how they react. And
well,
some of the voice
sync's all right, but, you know, they made some crucial errors in my Ford touch. And, you know, they're fixing them now. So,
but to your point of, you know, keep the brand image and all that running strong, has this hurt at all?
Well,
I can't see why it wouldn't, but how serious or not is it?
Well, it's serious in that any time you have any type of discussion of quality or reliability around your product at the volume we've had, of course it's a concern. But I think you have to balance it with the reality that almost 80% of customers are asking for my touch and sync systems in the car. So you get to the point where, you know, and I know a lot of this from my previous life at OnStar and leading infotainment at GM, is that on the one hand, some people can get frustrated and fill out a survey a certain way. But on the other hand, it's also a big reason that people buy, and it's had a lot of role in defining Ford as a high-tech brand. We have the highest technology image of any other auto brand in the industry right now, and that's holding. And we also know it's a reason to purchase, so that builds the value of the brand. And we also know that in a lot of electronics categories, when you get into devices and phones and home electronics, you see similar patterns of dissatisfaction with people getting familiar with their technology. It's why people looked at the blinking 1200 on their VCRs for so many years because they didn't even want to bother to program the clock. So it's a problem, yes. Is it something that's going to overwhelm the company?
But
no.
There's the dichotomy. J.D. Powers and and Consumer Reports clobbers you on it, and you get an 80% take rate.
Yeah.
And Ford had an event today, as you know, and Joe Hinrichs says the customer satisfaction on cars with my Ford Touch is higher than the customer satisfaction without.
That's right.
So what's that tell you about the J.D. Power and Consumer Reports
stuff? You're predicating this assumption on the belief that all of the problems are associated with the infotainment system. Right. And so if there is a certain number of people, you know, who participate in IQS that don't have it, so there's the 20% of the 80%, right,
mm-hmm.
that has a factor that has to play in there as well. So, I mean, there could be other issues besides this focus that we all seem to have on that. I mean, because if you look at you know, the J.D. Power Lincoln ties with industry average. Now, that isn't so good. Be tied with industry average, and you don't hear a whole lot of people bitching about my Lincoln Touch, right?
Well, if you look at the difficulty in the statistics and the numbers are that because we have such a high penetration rate of the systems, when people are dissatisfied, it over-indexes the total number. So if you normalize the take rates and say, let's say that our take rates for those types of systems was on the industry average, you would see that our TGW or things gone wrong pulls right into the average line. So it's one factor. But that's not an excuse, and they understand that. And as Peter said, I mean, there's been an amazing amount of energy to improve the system. A lot of it is a lag time that occurs when people get updates into the car. I've been driving the latest release, the 3.5 release, now for 6 months. I nearly had a hiccup, and I put multiple devices on it. And we've got another update that'll be coming out soon that'll sharpen up even more. So eventually we'll get over that. We're, as been known, we're doing some of the interface is going to change with buttons and some things, but we're already seeing competitors' rates. The Cadillac Q system, has gone up. Cadillac's number went up exponentially in TGWs, and it knocked them down 10 pegs. So we took one for the industry, first in, first out. And so it's an advantage. We're learning, and we will learn more and continue to lead in this. But it's not just the J.D. Power survey is but one piece. There's a lot of brands that have not done traditionally very well in the TGW 90-day window, but have amazing brand equity and do very well. And, you know, for us, we want to exceed as a brand, and we want to exceed also in the survey. So a lot of energy, but you push through it.
Well, as we've talked about, the initial quality survey is...
It's 90 days. It's the first 90 days
and
of ownership.
I hate to bring this up again, but it's so classic, you have to. It's just that, remember, the buyers of the Hummer H2 complained about fuel economy in their J.D. Power initial quality survey.
Well, you're bringing up a big issue, too, is that look at how that survey has evolved dramatically over the years, right? It used to be a thing gone wrong was you pulled the door handle and it came off in your hand, right, or a thing gone wrong is you sat 6 hours on the freeway waiting for a tow truck. Now a thing gone wrong is I don't like the position of my cup holder,
right,
or I'm disappointed with my... So, and again, all that to say, it keeps driving us. But I think somebody asked a question at the APA event, you know, are these types of surveys a killer of innovation? Like, are you disincentivizing the industry to do things that might somehow compromise you in the survey? And that's a really relevant question. You don't want to curb innovation or risk taking because you're afraid you're going to get hammered.
Well, you just have to remember it's one measure of quality. Because to your point, Chris, it's all TGWs, things gone wrong. Well, what about the things gone right?
Because to your point, where we excel greatly.
The Subarus, the Land Rovers, the Volkswagens, the Alfa Romeos back in the past were always at the bottom of the list and had some of the most loyal customers in the business.
Yeah, and I wanted to say again, when you look at the things gone right, and you look at the reason people are selecting cars, we were just talking before this show. I mean, we've gained more market share as a brand than any other car company in the land, and it's all happening in places like California, New York, all the places we've been hammered for decades. And it's the looks, it's the dynamics, it's the technology. That's what's bringing people back to Ford and is putting us on an upper level. And I would say that if you had it all to do over again and you looked at the net benefit we've gotten from being imaged as a high-tech, cutting-edge company because of Sync and MyFord Touch, you'd probably do it all over again, because I would argue. And as I was president of OnStar, every stinking interview I would go down the coast in California and do trying to sell the idea that we got it at GM, the first thing they'd ask you is, why does your system suck and why is Sync so great? And it would just drive me crazy.
Well, now look at Ford's presence at the Consumer Electronics Show.
I think it's
the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know.
Look, I test drive everything. I don't have a problem with my Ford Touch. I'll tell you, to your face, I think the Chrysler U-Connect, in my experience, is the best out there. But this is all a moving target. And, you know, it could be later this year I'll go, no, it's something else is better. And maybe it would be Ford Touch.
We've talked about it before. We're in like the second inning of this thing, right? There's going to be an amazing evolution of technology in the car. And it's not all going to be about just how you consume music and use apps in the vehicle. The connectivity in the vehicle, both what you bring in, what's embedded, what you get in through other inputs, satellite radio and whatever, are going to continue to just be harmonized, and your car is going to be very much integrated into everything else you do. The winning strategy is going to be, how do you surprise and delight and really satisfy and build loyalty through that tie to the car? And I think some of there'll be a shakeout of what people value as they get exposure. The market's going to drive the value of these systems and also the design of them.
Chris, you know, you're mentioning the OnStar experience. And if we think back to that, I mean, that was largely predicated on Hughes technology and technology that GM got from EDS. Mm. So here are two non-automotive companies that were bringing a lot of technology to bear on the car. And, you know, I often wonder whether it's Ford or General Motors or Chrysler or Toyota or Volkswagen or whomever else, whether, you know, the competence is not necessarily in the interface. The competence is not in the infotainment electronics. The competence is in making, you know, cars that we all love to drive and look at and be in. And whether there isn't too much of an internal reliance now on developing this, because it's thought to be something that will provide this advantage, when it might not be a better approach to completely go outside and basically source that and bring it in.
Well, that's a perennial problem for Ford. They have an IT division that really operates like their own little fiefdom, and it's hurting Ford, and it's going to be addressed sooner or later. because I think there's a lot of outside thinking available to Ford that they're not using.
On the other hand, you know, if this is such a critical part to the car, don't you want to control that?
Well, up to a point, but, you know, when there's good stuff that you can get, but you're just unwilling to do it because it wasn't invented here, you're hurting yourselves, and your competition is going up, going to go right by you.
Well, I think the relevant question, though, is like what partnerships, alignments, or who should be sort of strategically driving what happens in the vehicle. And I think the reality is everybody wants to get connected in the car, and there's very powerful forces out there, you know, other companies that are doing a lot of innovative things to do that through your device and your phone. I don't think it's any one answer. I think Peter's right. You've got to have a great understanding of what's available to you on the outside, and you've got to marry that with people who really know the car and the vehicle space. And I will tell you, all of this, as we've talked many times in the past, is a function of driver distraction, safety. And I think if we've learned anything in the last couple of years is that, you know, drivers can very quickly be overwhelmed by what engineers and other, you know, high-tech designers feel to be quite logical technology. And you know, if you spend any time in focus groups, and I spend a lot of time in it around human factors, it's a little humbling, you know, how quickly many customers are overcome in sort of understanding not just your infotainment stack, but just the technology in the car in general. And I think the other thing that'll be interesting to watch is as the shakeout occurs and where the value, what alignments and partnerships did car companies take on to get the upper hand? Because all the partners want to stay agnostic. They don't want to get in bed with any one manufacturer. I mean, Apple has just resisted this at all. I'm sure people have brought bags of gold to put Apple iOS in the car exclusively, and they've kept them out as a matter of strategy. So.
But there was that announcement at the Worldwide Developers Conference mm-hmm. that Apple will be going into.
Yeah, that's Apple. It's been actually in the works for a while. It's called Apple. They used the code name or the way they were sourced is like the Apple Out, iPod Out or iOut. And it's basically an ability to mirror certain apps, the app environment off of an iOS device within the vehicle. And I think Apple's really good about working with all the manufacturers. So I think you'll see that capability. But even then, you're still doing that as a function of driver distraction and how people interface with the rest of the car and what the app can interface with the vehicle CAN bus and what information it can get. It's a complex environment, both at the human level and with the vehicle.
See, if you think about it, I mean, the two big technology companies that are doing the best around the world, let's say, Apple and Google, right? Hmm. Hardware, software. What have these guys done? They've gone very minimalist, right? You go to the homepage of Google. What do you have? Logo. You know, everything else is white, right? And why did the iPod become successful? Simplicity, right?
And design.
The design, and you know, and Johnny Ives is creating the new interface, which is going to even be more simple. So he's going to make it, you know, he's going to drive it to hardcore simplicity. And it almost seems to me that, you know, those guys are very comfortable in their own skin, and they're saying, we can do it this way. And car guys, not just, you know, I'm not just talking about Ford. It's just, you know, the industry seems like, ooh, we got bells and whistles and frosting and sparkles, and, you know, we're going to put all this stuff in there. But, you know, it's not, you know, being, you know, human factors is not being addressed the same way that these guys have been masters at.
I'd love to see, you know, going back to the J.D. Power stuff where Ford's getting dinged for My Ford Touch, they also do another study, of course, the Vehicle Dependability Survey. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's dependability, right? So I don't know where that survey goes. But to your point, Chris, you get in these cars, and even I go through it. How the hell do I sync my phone up to this car? Everybody does it differently. Some are very bad at it. Some are easy breezy. But nonetheless, I'm jumping in, as probably we all are, into a different car every single week, even more than once a week. But once somebody's lived with a car for a while, what then do they tell the pollsters what they think of the system? I'd love to know what somebody said 3 years ago when they first got My Ford Touch, or think of it now.
Yeah, I can't cite specific, I don't know if I have enough visibility on the actual data, but I can tell you, again, studying it from my past and understanding that dynamic, particularly from the journalist perspective, because you guys are jumping from car to car and it all is overwhelming, and they've had 14 car, you know, phone profiles in the system in the last week, and the system's memory's loaded up, and all these factors come in. The reality is more what you said. People get comfortable with what they understand and like about the system, and they leave the rest alone. It's the same dynamic with apps on the phone. I forgot the average number, but it was high. Like in the early days of iPhone, the average phone had like 55 apps. But if you find out, people use 4 regularly.
And that's me.
And that's your phone, your email, your music, and your browser. So the same thing's true in the car. The other thing that's interesting about the car and how you do infotainment strategy is, think about it. 95% of the time you're in the car, you're doing the exact same thing day after day. It's not like you get in the car going between point A and point B for your 20-minute drive and get all of a sudden stupid about where the next McDonald's is, or want to go get a drive-by Groupon deal at the sporting goods store as you go by. It's just not the reality. So people tune the car to what they like and how to use things the way they want to, and they get familiar with it. And once they figure it out, it's usually not a problem.
I bet you the survey data, as long as it asks those kinds of questions, what do you think 3 years now after living with this, what do you think of it? Yeah. I don't know as that certainly Consumer Reports doesn't do that, and I don't think the J.D. Power...
But tell me about Consumer Reports. Here's the company that just, pretty much put Tesla, over the top from a love and adoration standpoint. If you get in a Tesla... what's like a 12-inch screen with more? I mean, it's absolutely overwhelming, the infotainment thing. And they didn't say a word about it.
Isn't it? I think it's 17.
They didn't, whatever it is.
Does the interface work better? I have not spent enough time in a Tesla to tell you.
I've been in the car at auto shows and seen it, but I can't believe their infotainment stack is any less distracting or complicated than anything else out there that caused Consumer Reports to go down to DEFCON 1.
That's a great point.
Tech guru, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I'm not claiming bias or anything.
The enlightenment.
but
as he said, as the head of all public relations for Ford of the Americas and product.
But it appears to me that there's a lot of excitement in the space. It's going to shake out. Things will normalize. It's with us. It's not going away.
No, it's only going to grow.
And people are going to learn to live with it, and then the market's going to determine what works best. But you need to innovate in that space, no question.
Yeah. Well, that's the hottest news segment in the automotive industry. For the enlightened. That's what Acura is going after, and that's what Tesla goes after. It's the enlightened. Seriously.
You went after Acura for their new tagline, made for mankind.
And it's aimed at the enlightened.
Enlightened women, right?
No, enlightened, period.
Uh-huh.
Movers like Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, they said it. Mark Rechtin from Automotive News got the interview, and that's what they said. So that's a new segment now. That's the hottest segment in the industry, the enlightened segment. And you're going to see Acura, Tesla, you name it, they're going to try to...
See a lot of difference between Acura and Tesla. It's interesting, because I've heard that Tesla's an amazing
vehicle. Where's the Acura?
It's a great car.
Yeah, I heard
it. I've driven it. It's awesome. And again, to see that they came from zero. I mean, they'd never done a full car, right?
Impressive.
They had... And put some batteries in a Lotus,
And I'm happy to... I'm happy that... Detroiters experienced hands of the Detroit auto industry made it work.
The Tesla.
Yeah.
As a car, as a driving car. Yeah, no question. The electronic stuff, I give the credit to everybody out in the valley. But the bones of the car, the structure,
Did you see, incidentally, speaking of Tesla, that they're doing the battery swap now?
And
it's...
Or talking about
no,
doing
no, there, there's a,
they're
a,
doing it?
They're going to do it, and...
Elon Musk is claiming that Shai Agassi, the guy who started Better Place, got the idea after touring Tesla.
There you go. But and where's Better Place now?
Bankrupt.
Yeah. They're doing 90-second battery swaps, and so Elon's new line is that you can go to these supercharger stations, which he's thinking about changing the name because it's no longer just a supercharger. And you can either get free electricity, because he said for life that you buy a Tesla, you're going to get the juice from the supercharger station forever, or swap out the battery. But the whole thing that I think that put Better Place down was the whole issue of economics. And so how do you support all of these batteries?
Well, you know,
batteries
the Chinese really looked at doing that, too, because, you know, they were going to leapfrog the whole global industry and go all electric. And there was a very good study that was done in China that said this battery swapping doesn't make any sense. It cannot scale up. Now, Tesla might get away with it.
Tesla, it's
because
a
it's such
yeah,
a low volume.
It's part of the experience. But I think you guys are just talking diesel, you know. And for those of us who have been around a while, I mean, everybody's got to remember the market is extremely rational, and the market is extremely cost sensitive. It's extremely cost sensitive, and it always shakes out that way. And, you know, I think the technological bets are always going to have to hedge towards the highest delivery for the lowest cost. That's a fact of the market. And I think that's, you know, inherent in what you're seeing, you know, the difficulty diesel having. I mean, Volkswagen's trying very hard to make a case economically for diesel, but the fact they have to work this hard to make a case for diesel economically is kind of all telling. Whereas, like, with, you know, technology, one thing I admired about Ford so much coming was just the franchise they created out of EcoBoost. And now we've got this 1-liter EcoBoost coming, 3-cylinder engine that's going to really, I think, just be a whole nother category of consumer, you know, education and enlightenment. But when you look at a dollar per dollar per mile per gallon delivered metric, it's hard to see a lot of these technologies and different, you know, approaches really winning out against the mainstream market, because there's too many competitive choices out there at a lower cost.
Really is. There really is. And then, you know, I keep talking about this natural gas and propane play that's really coming to the fore. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, could really turn this market on.
The biofuel stuff's really interesting. Some of these biofuel concepts where you put 70, 80 miles of range on board the vehicle with natural gas and leave the gasoline capability alone.
I think that's an interesting interim step. But it's like hybrids. You got two powertrains, essentially. And with the biofuel, you have two different, completely separate fuel delivery systems. It's just not the ideal. And that's why I say I think that's an interim play. But look, if this natural gas comes on, like it looks like it is happening, I don't know so much about pass car because there's an infrastructure issue. But on the commercial side,
it makes a lot of sense. And the tanks can be, I think, better amortized and packaged in the vehicle, factored from a cost standpoint.
Yeah.
I just read something about research. I think Navigant Research says by 2020 or 2025, they're expecting 35,000 or 35 million natural gas vehicles.
Just in the U.S.? That sounds, I'm an optimist on it, and that sounds wildly optimistic to me.
More optimistic than you are, John.
Hey, why don't we get into some of the questions from the audience, the rapid fire part. So, Carmen, let's run rapid fire. Okay, Chris, here's one for you, a product question all about Ford. Leaf Springs wants to know, why did the F-150 go with a cap-out design? I'm not sure what a cap-out design is. On the new model, instead of leaning more towards the Atlas concept. Well, the Atlas we only just saw in January. Right?
Atlas is a concept. I don't know.
Was he talking about the new Tremor, which is a?
Oh, maybe that's it. Yeah.
The Atlas, the next 150 is, you know, that's a different thing. I think he might be talking about the Tremor.
I'll bet you're right. And just with the regular cab.
Yeah, the Tremor's just a great way to lightweight a vehicle and get the lightest possible package with the most possible, you know, packaged horsepower and make it look really cool. So
here we got a picture of it up on the screen. What's the lightweighting part of it?
Well, I mean, you're just using you're not doing a super crew with four doors and
smallest cab.
And
smallest cab with the most powerful engine.
Shortest wheelbase.
And a 410 rear end.
Yeah, so this thing has the best scoop potential and
lightest weight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the Atlas? What about all this aluminum stuff everyone keeps thinking it's going to be?
Look, the current F-150 is absolutely dominating the market. In fact, our new F-150 just won out in the cars.com Pop Mechanics shootout against the new Dodge and the new Chevy, and we came out on top. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that there's a lot of great things for the current vehicle still to come. And Atlas is a great look at what a vehicle, concept could look like in the future. And that vehicle is, I think, got some, you know, amazing potential. But we haven't really said anything about what it's made of or any of the other attributes.
You haven't, but everybody else is talking about it. The one thing I will give the Atlas a lot of kudos for is, remember at the Detroit show, the designers picked that as the best concept of the show.
Yep.
And this is your competition, picking your truck as the best concept there.
Yeah. You know, the one thing you can say about the Ford Motor Company is they really know trucks. And, you know, it is the backbone for the North American business. And I think it's safe to say that the current vehicle and any future iterations are in very good hands.
What about smaller ones?
You mean smaller pickups? No, again, I think from where we are in the marketplace and just based on past knowledge and things, you know, sticking with F-150 and the many variations we have is the best situation for us.
I wish I had a dollar for everybody who's asked me, why doesn't Ford redo the Ranger?
Well,
and I don't mean the international Ranger. I mean the one that we had here.
Yeah, it's just a business decision based on, you know, where's the best return for the business.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying there's a lot of people out there who would love a little truck.
Yeah, you know, but everyone forgets that those little trucks, you know, Wabity, there was a certain group of them. I mean, you had those were the $129 lease deal vehicles to keep everybody in cafe. I mean, there's a lot of romancing of the past, but, you know, I wasn't at Ford since they had it, but at GM, it was not a very good business ever.
Yeah.
It was a cafe strategy.
No, same for Ford.
Yeah,
it was that five-cylinder engine back in those days.
It's
$35 million worldwide, so.
Okay. Oh, worldwide.
Yeah,
so. Oh, that could happen.
So. 2020. But.
Yeah. You know, right now, there's already, at least if you talk LPG, there's already 17 million vehicles in the world right now running on it. So I don't know if that's factoring into, or if they're just saying CNG is going to be the number that you quoted. But
big potential.
Yeah, big potential. Okay, Roman Koch has a good question. He says, the Taurus doesn't seem to get much ink and seems almost like an also-ran in the big sedan segment. How do you get it on a buyer's must-see list?
Wow. Well, the show is one of those excitement getters, which just was redone this year. The vehicle got an update last year and has held its own. A large sedan segment in general is pretty tough going right now. Taurus Police Interceptor business, another very profitable commercial business that we do with that vehicle is very important. But it's a good point. I mean, we can't lose sight of some really strong products, and Taurus is still a very strong product in the segment. So
it needs a rethink, though, exterior-wise.
The Taurus.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Total rethink.
It's dated. It's very dated right now, even though the car drives fine. But
yeah, car drives great.
But didn't the front clip get changed somewhat?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did, but... I mean, the issue for the whole segment is, and it wouldn't just be unique to Ford, is that you've got, you know, the long term viewpoint on the large sedan market in the U.S. is shrinking, and the number of entrants, you know, are increasing. So it's just not as you look at where you're going to take scarce resources and where you're going to invest, you know, there's a lot of questions to how you make those bets. I mean, Taurus does a good business, and it's solid for us. And, you know, in terms of how much you've refreshed it or whatever, it's a question for the future.
So is Fusion size the size you see as going forward? As
CD being... segment is much stronger in general, yeah. And then as you move up, you know, the crossovers are taking more and more away from what used to be the large luxury segment.
Dave Arnoldson says, if truck MPG is so important, what will Ford have in its truck to fight Dodge's, he says, 30 MPG highway, 3-liter diesel, 8-speed tranny at the end of the year?
Well, I don't know where Dodge is going to be on fuel economy. I will say fuel economy is a consideration in pickup trucks, but it's far from being the consideration in pickup trucks. In fact, when you do a lot of the talking to customers around what they want in a truck, what comes out almost first and foremost is durability and powertrain performance and capability. Fuel economy is a factor, but I don't know that somebody eking out a 1 mile per gallon or 2 mile per gallon highway claim is going to find themselves heavily advantaged in the marketplace. But, you know, Dodge has got a really good truck, and diesel's a very important segment. So, you know, it's just showing you, you know, how lucrative it is and how important it is. But I would argue with EcoBoost and the performance enhancements that we're going to have going forward, you know, I think we're very confident that F-150 is going to be.
But from a messaging point of view, I mean, isn't it recently we're seeing a whole lot of attention being paid to fuel economy? I mean, Silverado coming out and saying, you know, we've got better fuel economy, and, you know, Dodge or Ram making the claims that, you know, it's getting the better fuel economy. Mm-hmm. You guys, when you had EcoBoost, were running the, you know, the Dennis Leary ads about, you know, telling you about how you're getting the performance mm-hmm. and the fuel economy that you
yeah,
want.
Yeah, but that's a different message, right? It's performance and fuel economy versus over-indexing on just fuel economy. And I think, again, as you sort of look at what drives purchase decisions, it's definitely a top part of the mix. It's just not the driver in trucks. It's not like it is in a sedan, in the CD segment, for instance.
Hey, we've got a couple of phone calls coming in here. Carmen, let's get to the first one.
My name is Jordan Grantzell. I sell Fords in Philadelphia. And a problem with my Ford Touch, I feel, is related to the customer's lack of familiarity with general technology. Mm. The average Ford customer isn't that tech savvy, and once they're explained the technology slowly, they do grasp it with relative ease. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I think once people are, you know, sort of grounded in what they want to use in the system, they get familiar with it, and it's usually a thing where some people like to do some things by voice, some things by touch, and some things by knobs. And you're at a point now, too, where in many of our models, if you don't like the touchscreen format, you can go back to getting systems that have the buttons. But, yeah, familiarity helps. And it's interesting, too, with those systems. You know, walking around your average BlackBerry or iPhone, there's probably 1,000 different things that device can do. You would have no idea. Sometimes I still go to the Apple store just to hang around with the guys who do the Apple classes just to pick up tips. And every time you go in there, you find out some other little trick or a shortcut or something you didn't know about exists. So, mm-hmm. But, yeah, training, getting people familiar is really important.
And we've got another phone call. Carmen, let's bring that one in, too.
Congratulations, Chris. It's terrific. Your father was great, too. The Chevy Cavalier used to get 750 miles on dual fuel ability with natural gas and gasoline together. Real inexpensive, too. Why don't Ford build something like that? I think it's worthwhile.
Wow.
God, I don't remember a dual fuel Cavalier.
Yeah, I don't either. It's dual natural gas.
For good reason.
Yeah. That a Cavalier went 700 miles is impressive at all. Yeah, just, right. But yeah, it's a great question. I think there's a lot of distance to go around alternative fuels yet. But again, I just want to point out, too, is that when we talk about biofuels in the rational market, I would argue that if somehow some scientist all of a sudden miraculously came up with this magic fluid called, you know, gasoline, after we'd all been driving around in battery-powered cars or even natural gas-powered cars, and they looked at the BTU energy per ounce at the cost that it can be delivered, everybody would herald this as the greatest technological breakthrough in the history of mankind. We got to get more of that. And when you do that as a function of at the tailpipe, we burn so clean now. I mean, the sophistication of technology to measure the tailpipe right now would blow your mind. So we're getting pretty good mileage.
Remember, you can buy a PZEV vehicle right now.
Yeah.
That emissions-wise is as clean as the average electric car, depending on how the grid.
It actually cleans the air in high pollution areas. The air it's sucking in is coming out cleaner.
Right. Now, we're not talking about CO2 in that measure. Nonetheless, that's how clean.
As Bob would say, that is a debatable subject anyway, if you believe such lies.
Because you used to work at GM. I'm not going to throw this question to you. I'm going to throw it to Peter.
Oh, please do.
No. And to Gary as well. GM Blue Badge wants to know, what is going on with the GM executives? Didn't they lose a high-level female executive recently?
Yeah, Susan Dougherty retired.
She quit, right?
Yeah, she quit. Maybe.
Because the way I'm reading it, she got passed over for the global Chevy job. And
well, Susan always thought she should be doing more than whatever it was she was doing at the time. And I think she just got tired of it. It was kind of one of those mutual things, you know. There are other things going on at GM right now that are more ominous, so we are watching intently.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, you think about it, she had that European job, and that's got to be a miserable job to have right now.
Well, not that miserable. You're living in Zurich.
Well,
there is that.
But I got to
testify that it's not a bad lifestyle.
But I got a feeling she'd come back monthly, and you know, and get her something handed to her, and then she'd go back and live in Zurich, and then she'd come back and get something handed to her, and go back, and so until. Chevy and GM and Europe get sorted out in terms of car sales. It's got to be a tough job to have.
Here's another easy one. Scott in Cleveland wants to know, do you see a Thunderbird in Ford's future?
Ooh, boy.
How about no?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen anytime
soon. Sorry, Scotty.
Never say never. Never say never, but yeah, I don't think that's going to happen for a long time. Jonathan Brown, and I'll throw this out to Peter. No, I'll start with you, Gary. Jonathan Brown says, it's been said that the European market needs to lose one or two major car manufacturers, so why save PSA at all, Peugeot Citroën?
Well, wasn't it announced today that the Peugeot family is going to be getting out of the way so General Motors can absorb more of it?
Is that true? Because I
just read that today.
Oh, I missed that.
And so
yeah,
could be one shoe dropping, no?
Whew. Yeah, that's...
I don't know, boy. That's
there's no guarantee.
But who's going to go away? I mean,
I'd say so much right now if it wasn't now inside the Ford tent.
Yeah. Yeah. Better you stay out of this part of the discussion, Chris. Kip on Truckin' wants to know, how exactly does a hydraulic hybrid work? Gary, you want to take that?
So the hydraulic hybrid that there's... what is it? Eaton has a system.
And so
basically what it is that you're compressing the fluid within a tank. And this is basically, they found the use for things like garbage trucks and buses, because these things are moving a short distance.
And you regenerate through stopping.
Exactly. And so you build the pressure, then use the pressure, and you just keep doing that. And so what you're doing is you're getting, you know, you're not, it's not a perpetual motion machine, of course, not yet, but until they find the magic fluid. But so it's just basically that you just have a reservoir that you compress the reservoir with a regenerative braking power and just move forward,
just like
that way.
In a hybrid or an electric car, when you step on the brake, you put juice back
in the battery.
Into the battery. Well, just think of it with a hydraulic hybrid. When you press on the brakes, it activates a pump which starts pumping hydraulic fluid into a tank under a high pressure. And then when you get back on the gas, boom, that pressure goes through the transmission, drives the wheels. And
the point being, you lose most of your efficiency launching the mass of the vehicle off the line.
But, you know,
and I think that actually, when remember the mighty Tonka concept vehicle that Ford had?
That was
I think that had a hydraulic hybrid.
Right, with Eaton. And the EPA is working on it with...
Yeah, they're working in Ann Arbor.
UPS trucks with... I don't think it's Eaton, though. I want to say it's Parker Hannifin, another hydraulic pump company. And then, you know, I was just over in Germany a couple of weeks ago looking at Bosch's stuff, and they're working with PSA, with Peugeot, to do a hydraulic hybrid, which it's an interesting story. I said, so when's this going to be available in showrooms? And they said, well... Peugeot says it's going to be ready in 2016. And I said, okay, well, you guys are developing it. What do you say? And they said, Peugeot says it'll be ready in 2016.
Yeah, that's a curious one, because you try to find out any information about that thing, and it seems non-existent. I mean, it's just not there. And so, I mean, when I have the unobtainium car, that will be ready in 2017. That will be better.
Joseph N. says, last week Peter had a mini rant about Cadillac. Bob Ferguson, VP of Global Cadillac, was in the Detroit News last week talking up expansion of the Cadillac portfolio. Joseph N. goes on to say, if GM follows this Cadillac everywhere strategy, what the heck are they going to leave for Buick?
Well, Buick's in China, and that China market leads whatever Buick's doing, you know? You know, in GM's mind, they'll be separate. The Cadillac is going to always be above Buick, blah, blah, blah. But since they have an Amway salesman running Cadillac now, maybe things will be perky and all positive.
So, Chris, you were there when they were making the decision about what to keep and what to not keep.
Well, so what was going to go all Sergeant Schultz on us by now? I know nothing.
Keep going. He hasn't asked the question yet.
No, so I'm just basically wondering if you can give us some insight into the rationalization of why they decided going forward to keep the brands they kept and jettison the other brands, rather than doing something like Ford with Lincoln and Ford, or
the thinking
Toyota
at the time,
Lexus,
yeah,
or Infiniti.
The thinking at the time. So I'm not editorializing. I'm not giving you my opinions, but basically what happened was, in all the financial analysis, there were a couple different hypotheses of how you could restructure the company, and there were different scenarios that you could work to. And as they went through the various scenarios, Chevrolet Global was pretty much a no-brainer. Staying in global luxury based on the considerable investment that had gone behind Cadillac was kind of a no-brainer. And then Buick, it came down to Buick, Opel, Saturn were kind of in the controversial stage. And then dumping Hummer and Pontiac were kind of the other end of the no-brainer. So of those three brands, there's a lot of debate. You keep Saturn, keep the Buick-Saturn alignment and try to work. You know, save Saturn as a retail network here and the equity you had. You had, you know, low number of dealers. And then there was the issue outlier. Then what did you do with GMC, which was, again, one that they wanted to just, with Pontiac, just throw off until you looked at the finances and you'd say, you just can't. It makes too much money. So it came down to the easiest global way to rationalize things was to keep Buick for China, which meant you kept Buick in the U.S. And at the time, you'll remember, there was a pretty good plan to sell Opel. So you kind of solved the conundrum of, you know, what to do. Because all those years we tried to get Opel and Buick, get Opel and Saturn aligned for the U.S. And so when they ended up not selling Opel, it kind of did mess up the plan. But by that time, all the ships had sailed. So
I keep remembering how there was 8 billion euros pledged by European governments to handle that restructuring. Boy, if they could rewind the clock.
First decision the new board made.
That's right. Here's a great question for all of us, and this is a good one. So ABHI says, what do you guys think of the Tesla and the Auto Dealers Association's fight? That's a good one. That's a great question. So just so anybody who doesn't know, you know, Tesla's got its own company stores. They want to sell their cars through their company stores. In the United States, that would seem to contravene all the dealer franchise laws set in all 50 states, and it's a battle royale going on right now. Just for anybody who wasn't aware of the background as to why ABHI asked the question.
It's huge. I mean, if you want to understand the power of the United States dealer body, look no further. The only ones that were able to go back and really pound the administration on post-bankruptcy policy, the dealers basically got everything they wanted back. There was a big plan to cut them up. And by the time their power in Congress was done, it was all thrown away very quickly.
But Tesla's won, a court case in Massachusetts, I want to say. I don't know if there's been a court case in California, but I know they're selling cars all through California right now. They just, I think, lost a case in Texas, or they're running into issues in Texas and in New York.
Well, every state's unique, so they're limited. They're not selling in every state, so that makes
not
it a
yet.
Little cleaner.
They want to.
But
isn't this somewhat analogous to the situation that existed in the early part of the 20th century when? Movie studios owned movie theaters, so the Fox Theater was owned by 20th Century Fox, and so basically they said all Fox movies will go to Fox-owned theaters, and therefore if you were a guy who was running the Bijou down the street and you wanted that movie, you couldn't possibly get it because it was controlled. And so similarly, I think there was this concern that if you had the car companies were controlling the channels through which they were sold, that, you know, again, if you wanted to sell
Chryslers or Fords or whatever, Teslas down the street, you know, you wouldn't have access to them because they wanted to keep that. And so, but I just wonder whether times haven't sufficiently changed whereby the accessibility of so many products are more readily grasped. Because I think one of the Tesla things is that he wants to sell over the internet. So it's just, you know, so it's just not the issue of whether they have a building or not. And so if you think about it, I mean, Amazon now is printing books. Is that illegal? I mean, they own the channel. You can't buy the Amazon book at Barnes & Noble, right? And so, you know, it's an interesting area, but I think to your point of the, you know, the lobbying power of that group is just
enormous. I just think it's they haven't had enough sales penetration to really warrant any serious concern, but as soon as they start getting traction and their sales start pushing into serious areas and they're competing against the dealers in those markets for market share, you just can't believe that they're going to sit back and not come back.
Well, you know, I don't know the whole history of the franchise laws, but my limited understanding is that they really didn't exist until after the Second World War. And it was then as, you know, the country really took off in a big way that the Detroit Three in particular really started to look at, hey, why do we have these middlemen between us and the customer? Why don't we start distributing things? And that's when dealers went, whoa, doggy, you know, we got to protect what we've got here. And that's when they really started pushing for franchise laws, which were to protect existing dealers from not having to compete against the factory in selling cars. Mm-hmm. Now, Tesla can make the argument, hey, we don't even have dealers. You know, we've got our own company store.
So they're just franchising no one.
So that's their argument. The dealer's argument, this is very interesting. I hadn't considered this, but this came out of the New York fight. The dealers are worried, yeah, you let Tesla do this, and the next wave that comes is the Chinese, and they don't even deal with us at all. So this isn't so much a fight against Tesla, although it is. It's a put a flag to make a stand right now, because otherwise we're opening the door for the Chinese to come in. And that was an interesting argument I hadn't considered.
And on that note,
well, we got one more phone call, and okay. Somebody took the time to call in, so let's take that call.
Aren't we kind of, question to your guests, aren't we kind of putting a lot of time into these MyTouch and Link systems when really, for the most part, you're going to dock your smartphone into your car and it's going to have your GPS and it's going to have your music and it's going to have your radio stations and everything? Aren't we just not going to move to like a docking station for your mobile device? Thank you.
Okay, can I answer that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds easy. But the reality is, even in Bluetooth profiles, which is supposed to be a ubiquitous, everything can be common format, the complexity and the changes in all the systems continually challenges the compatibility. And so the idea of a mirrored system that you can just plug in and everything kind of comes up, that's one that's not lost on anybody in the industry. Executing it is extremely hard because the platforms and the phones change so rapidly. And the other problem there is that it doesn't really anticipate where the phones might go. So you might be great now. Average car sticks around for 10, 11 years now. What were you carrying around in your pocket 10 years ago as a phone, right? That's the challenge with that strategy.
But isn't the thought, and I think that what the viewers are calling in too, is just give me a screen. And now everything
sounds that it sounds really easy, but it's not that easy.
Now, Spark, the Chevy Spark's taking a step along those lines.
They are. That's an LG system. And even in that case, and I was there for that development, is they are continually challenged and chasing profile changes in phones. And again, it works on what you know today. But what happens if a whole new architecture, a whole new platform comes out? And so I think that's this issue of it's not going to be any one thing. It's going to be the harmonizing of things, and they're all going to have to evolve together. That's why we were talking about the issue of partnerships and having the right people in the house. Hmm.
Good stuff, Chris. It's been great having you on the show today. Yeah, really, really cool. And congratulations
Thanks.
On your massive promotion there in Ford
I'm
Public
really
Relations.
Excited to be there. Great people, great company.
Gary, great having you back as always.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah.
Gary.
Pete, good
John.
Seeing you. Peter.
Yes.
Hey, we should let everybody know, next week is 4th of July week. We always shut down Autoline lock, stock, and barrel. No Autoline after hours, no Autoline daily, nothing. So take a week off. Join us in another 2 weeks. Our guest then is going to be Art Anderson, the chief engineer of the Fiat 500L, the newest line in a car in their lineup. But until then, thanks for having tuned in, and join us again here in 2 weeks.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.